Danielle's in there working, but she can
listen. I just got done.
Oh, okay, bye. Okay.
This is September 11th, 2014, Pearset Seminar. I tend to record these things because I put them up on my website, and my former graduate students from other institutions sometimes ask about them, particularly if they happen to be represented in. Subject this semester is parasite genetics, and because I really don't know anything about parasite genetics, I thought what I'd do is talk about some of the typical conversations that went on for years and years and years, if not decades, at local establishments on Friday afternoons, where we would adjourn to just talk about stuff that you never really got to talk about in class. Back in the mid-90s, well, I've always had undergraduates working in the lab, and back in the mid-90s, I had a doctoral student named Ben Hanelt, who is really fairly well known now as a scientist at the University of New Mexico. And so I said to Ben one time, you know, here are all of these undergraduates working in the lab. How do we get them engaged in the kinds of conversations we have on Friday afternoon at Barry's? And he said, this is pretty simple. We'll just go to coffee at 3:30 and have these conversations. And then at 4:30, the grown-ups can go to the bar. And so that worked really, really, really well. And I would say to you, to undergraduates, anybody, other undergraduates in here, if you have some faculty member that you really believe has something to say to you, I would go to that person and say, we want to make a weekly date to go have coffee off campus and talk big talk. And it will work like a charm. It will multiply the value of your college education many times over. So, now, what do we talk about when we go to the bar? And the answer is a lot of stuff that really very often turns into doctoral dissertations. So today, though, I want to talk about four topics. One of them is what I'm, and these are really my title, my perceptions of what these topics are. And if you want this thing, just send me an email and I'll send it to you. First of these is what I'm going to call the Bliss-Fisher-Crofton-May fallout problem. Second one is the parasite community problem. Third one is the so-called complex life cycle. And the fourth one is the Red Queen problem. Now, the other thing is that this show was put together on my laptop, and this is a Mac, which I hate, so there's going to be some format issues involved here.
Oh, I see. Problem.
Yeah.
Now we were just switching into Spanish.
So let me talk about the Bliss-Fisher-Crofton-May fallout problem. And this is a problem, I'm calling it a problem because it really started this whole idea of studying the distribution of parasites in host populations in a certain way began among the parasite community with Crofton's paper on distribution. I even forgotten what he was looking at. Maybe ACANTs and intermediate hosts downstream, something of the sort.
Don't remember.
Yeah, but the conceptual contribution to that Crofton paper was the observation that in many, many cases, if not most cases, of what we call macroparasites with worms, for example, that don't multiply as such inside the host, the vast majority of all the hosts are either when you do a plot like this, how many parasites per host plotted against the number of hosts, when you do that kind of a plot from field data, you discover that the vast majority of your hosts are either not infected or infected very lightly, and there are a few hosts that are heavily infected. And so these are really, you know, if these are parasites that are shedding eggs, then these are the big contributors to the next generation of parasites. Now, the Bliss-Fisher contribution to this whole issue was that there is a classic paper, and here's an example of it. You don't have to necessarily understand it or read it, but it's kind of fun to have in your hand and actually look at it. This is the Blissfisher paper. And you're...
We can actually touch it? We don't have to just...
You can touch it. No, you can touch it.
Wow.
You can touch it.
No, you have to read it on your computer.
No, this is... You can touch the Blissfisher paper. I only brought 10 copies. But actually, anybody want my copy? It's not... You can get it online. You can get it as a PDF.
Download it.
Yeah. Bliss and Fisher, what this paper actually did was tell parasitologists how to calculate the parameters to fit this curve. Okay, so this is the paper that when Crofton and Bliss and Fisher, when parasitologists started noticing this phenomenon in many, many different systems, then we all went to Bliss and Fisher and figured out how to fit this curve. And what that meant was we could take field data and calculate the expected values for each of these and then run a chi-squared test. And in order to do that, though, you had to calculate the exponent of the Nekhludoff binomial, which is called K. Now, in current software like MATLAB and some others, it's not called K, but at the time it's called K. So once we went through this paper and figured out how to calculate K as well as the confidence limits for K, then we started applying that negative binomial distribution equation to every conceivable kind of parasite we could collect field data on. And we started writing programs to do the calculations for us and so forth. So that's where that came in. That all happened about the middle 70s through the early 80s. Now, the May part of this is really Robert May, who was a physicist at Princeton. I think he was at Princeton. And he decided to use the mathematics associated with a negative binomial to do an enormous body of theoretical work in which he proposed a whole lot of ideas, namely that these kinds of infections could regulate a parasite population by killing these hosts. And so he then also called K a clumping parameter. And so there were, and he was so powerful as a scientist and so influential that everybody was terrified of Robert May intellectually. Now, what this thing means is, for example, if you're going to go into an area and try to control a parasitic and sort of infection and population, whether it's a veterinary herd or a human population, by giving them drugs, then you really have a choice. You can give doses to everyone, in which case you're treating people who probably don't need it and won't do any good, or you can do the diagnostics to find out who these folks are and treat them. And so there are a whole lot of factors really rest on this kind of a population distribution. Now, the genetics part of it is, of course, that let me get to this one right here. So, I'm calling it a problem simply because it focused so much research attention on what we wanted to believe. And we wanted to believe that these were either killing, hosts were either dying out here, or these hosts were the super infectors or the super spreaders. And not only that, but the fact that these parasites might have might be selecting against those hosts meant that they were potentially drivers of evolutionary change. Right? Now, I did a biological abstract search using negative binomial and parasit with a wild card got 439 hits for the last 60 years. Okay. And I want to talk about hits a little bit. Now, what are the genetic implications of this phenomenon? So what that curve, what that distribution curve really says to you is that if you consider the range of genetic diversity in parasites and the range of genetic diversity in hosts, then that frequency distribution really tells you that most of the parasite genetic diversity dies or is missed, and just a little fraction of it ends up in a fraction of the host genetic diversity. And the next generation, or generations thereafter, the factors that really determine where this range slides and where this range slides are largely ecological. And this is really what happens. So in order for that distribution, in my mind, and in Barry's talk, in order for that distribution to be really important in an evolutionary sense, this range has to kind of creep, well, instead of very widely back and forth. And even, you know, when you go to the field station for 4 or 5 years and do field work on any system out there, you really do discover that it's these ecological conditions that are really determining the relationships between these two curves, or those two diagrams. So this, I think, is the key genetic issue that we really haven't addressed with genetic research or markers that I know of in any kind of serious way.
So on the generalization one, do you mind if we just chat here?
No, go ahead.
So those parasites that have, basically looking at that thing, it says low genetic diversity up there, and then it expands?
No, what I'm saying is the fraction of parasite genetic diversity.
Okay, right there.
That this is the whole range, okay. But the fraction that ends up infecting.
Got it.
Is mapped onto a certain range of host genetic diversity.
Okay.
And what you really can't say, I don't believe, from the literature, is whether or not this little trapezoid stays in the same place generation, or whether it slides back and forth,
okay.
Because of ecological conditions. And if it slides back and forth, then that parasite distribution is only of ecological interest and not of genetic evolutionary interest.
Okay.
So I did a biological abstract search using native binomial and host genotype, and I got one hit out of the last 60 years. And this is the paper on a Staphylococcus. And I couldn't even find this particular journal, even though it pops up in biological abstracts. If I look at those two keywords plus host death, then I get 4 hits for the last 63 years. If I do it on population regulation, I get 9. And I don't remember what those were, but it may in fact all be Robert Mays. And if I use aggregated and distribution instead of negative binomial, however, I get 13 out of those for the last 63 years. So something's going on to limit the published research on this phenomenon that came into serious interest among parasitologists as a result of Crofton, Bliss, Fisher, and May in the 70s and 50s. Okay. So my unsupported conclusion is that I hope this focus on distributions, especially aggregated ones, would confirm our beliefs about this hope is just simply not fulfilled. Okay, so that's your history. Let's talk about the parasite community problem a little bit. Right? So the basic question is, and this is a typical, what I would call just a host parasite community that you find in a pond in western Nebraska. A centarchid fish of some kind with ectoparasites, a couple of different phyla, larvae, transmitted in a variety of ways. Okay.
So there's different phyla. There's an arthropod and there's a monogene.
So we have arthropods, platyhelminthes, adults, platyhelminthes, larvae, nematode adults, acanthocephalon adults.
Cercaria coming out, or going in, I see cercaria coming in.
Yeah, this is tissue penetration.
Right.
Cestodes, bothriocephalus, and some of this stuff.
Okay, so those of you who haven't had heavy duty parasites.
Have you had Life 121?
I'm not here.
So, I'm not going to ask you, did you talk about platyhelminthes?
I recognize it, yeah. Definitely. In a while,
I talked
about it.
Okay. So, at any rate, here are 1, 2, 3, 4.
Five. Well, four parasites, but then another.
What's that one?
Looks like a.
Oh, that's a. That's a trematode. That's an adult.
Digene.
Now this is that's a digene. So there are at least four phyla in several different classes. All right. So let's get back though to the genetics question. That is, do host animals respond to foreign proteins? And the answer is absolutely yes, unqualified. And if you do a biological abstract search using parasite and immunology with the wild card thing, you get 31,000 and hits, right? So the answer is yeah. People are studying this stuff seriously. Now, what's happened here is that the Macintosh has screwed up my equations.
Oh, dang.
So what you're seeing in here is a big sigma sign and a big sigma sign.
Oh.
Okay? So that's what it is. This is the sum of the sums. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And this is the equation that you use to really fit what's called a species density distribution. And I'll explain that in just a second. So, do animals respond to foreign proteins? And so you have a couple of answers, a couple of alternative hypotheses. And the answer is yeah, such responses alter the environment for other animals that are occupying that environment that might enter. And so when the environment is the host and the other animals are the parasite, one hypothesis or response would be that the first parasites that go in alter the environment in some way that affects the ability of the other parasites to succeed, or that they have no effect whatsoever. So this equation, I'm not going to write it. Y'all can just envision this. This is a pair of sums. What this really says to you, this is actually for you, kind of remember your pre-calc. This is a version of the binomial generator equation for n things taken x at a time. And if all, let's say, if all successes were equal, then you would get a normal approximation, a discrete normal approximation. Okay? However, if you're talking about parasite species density distributions, and what I've done here is just simply draw a figure assuming that there's a total of 10 possible kinds of parasites that a host could get, and this is not unusual, so let's say 10. So uninfected ones are no problem. If you get only one, you can either have parasite A or parasite B or parasite C or parasite J. However, your probability of getting A is not necessarily the same as getting B, or B is not necessarily the same as getting C. So even though you get a bar, if you actually go to the field and do this work, you get a bar, that's not really the same as drawing, say, red marbles out of a sack of red and white. Now, it gets interesting, however, when you start looking at the combinations. So this one would be, this bar would be the number of hosts with two different parasites. So this could be AB or AC or AD, blah, 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 or BC or BD. So it's this different number. However many there are here is really a product of all of the separate probabilities of each of the 10 plus multiplied times the probability of not having one of those multiplied times n factor over x minus n times n times x factor. Now, as an aside, thinking about Barry's bar and grill, we did this, we wrote this code to actually calculate the expectance here, but I spent a year trying to figure out how to actually write it, and finally got so mad that I sat down and actually wrote the code for each of those combinations instead of figuring out a way to do it. And I did that for the parasites of Fungulus zebrinus, the plains killifish, and we published all that stuff. Then one day at Barry's, I bet Rich Clopton a case of beer over who could get the general formula written fastest, and he won. However, he just got it up to 15. So then we sent the problem to his brother, David, in California, who's an electrical engineer, and David solved that problem of how to actually write the code to calculate the expectance and see if this fit in about an hour, and sent us back the program and called it thinking, like, come on, you idiots, here's how you do it. So
for any number.
Pardon me?
For any number.
Any number, up to 1,000. Yeah. And this is now a piece of computational technology just waiting for some kind of a genetic application. I mean, really. Yeah.
So we should, we'll think about that.
Think about that a little bit?
Well, what we can do is we can think about that from, if we can look at the genetics of the system, so we can actually look at the genes per piece of the code, and actually then we could then look at the interactions between and among the different genes for each of the parasites and the gene each host. So it gets a little more complicated because we're throwing the parasite genes in with the host genes. So it's like doubles the complexity.
Well, yeah, we'll toward the end, when I start talking about the Red Queen problem, we'll come back to this a little bit because, for example, these might be frequencies of alleles in a population. So the probability of getting that allele on a Hardy-Weinberg issue would be whatever P1 is. So then the question might become, okay, what kind of a genetic environment are you if you have this allele and that allele? Are you the same as if you have that allele and that allele? Or these three or these three? Or which of these combinations of alleles produce susceptibility versus resistance?
Right.
Or any other kind of trait? So, okay?
Yeah. We talked about this about 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
We didn't get to that point.
Yeah, we're still talking about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what we really have for an X number of parasite species, and I'm saying for those of you that are just coming into parasite seminar, this is a very important phrase, disregarding infrapopulation. Well, the term infrapopulation means the number of parasites of a single species inside a host. So the presence of parasite A is quite different from the numbers of parasite A. So when, as soon as you say disregarding it for populations, then you're really disregarding, you're simplifying your discussion, but you're also saying, okay, the next time around we're going to talk about infrapopulations, and that's going to make our discussion much more difficult. Yeah, much more difficult. So this is what we really just kind of defined as the doctoral problem from hell. And in order to even begin to ask this question of whether or not one parasite has any kind of a evolutionary effect on host population, somebody really, in order to deal with that, needs to work on this problem. The non-parasitologists in general have approached that problem by ignoring everything else. And once they ignore it, then their problem from hell is turned into something that fits their dream. And the worst offenders here are at least some ecologists who jump on a host-parasite relationship that seems to damage the host in some way and start trying to make the case that what we have is a pathogen that's driving host evolution. Okay. Now, let's talk about the complex life cycle problem a little bit. And this gets back to one that we've talked about, or at least that I've talked about in seminar a time or two before, and we're still working on that paper and hope to get it submitted sometime in the next few weeks, about that deals with the trematode life cycle model. So here's the life cycle problem. Okay. Here's one straight out of a textbook, an example of a paragonimus. And actually, when you go out and leave here, if the lights are on in the hall, you can look up, you can find a picture of a guy named Frank Sogandaris Bernal, who was Harold Manter's last graduate student. One of his last graduate students was Harold Manter from Manteron. And Frank Sogandaris Bernal is still alive. He smokes and drinks constantly. He never goes anywhere without a fifth of Jack Daniels in his hand. And he will talk to you on the phone. Hi, Scott, how you doing? He's in his 90s. So this is Frank. Okay. You have a picture of Frank?
I can't find it. I thought I had a stack of his imprints from his Henry Baldwin work.
Well, Frank was the one who did a sort of a... this is a parasite, a lung parasite, that occurs throughout much of Asia. And it actually gets transported with food, exported food products around the world in a lot of cases. And there are parasites of this genus that are present in carnivores outside of Asia too. But this is a complex life cycle. So eggs are shed, they either hatch or a snail eats them. There's some asexual reproduction inside the snail, generations and generations. The parasites are shed into the water. In this case, they're picked up by what's called a second intermediate host. In this case, it's a freshwater crab. And these things encyst in the gills, mainly of those crabs. And when you handle those crabs, and don't necessarily cook them well, or they're breaking apart and they're not cooked well, then these little cysts get on your hands, and you do this, and you get infected and stuff. So,
what's it called? The thing that people eat is called drunken crab.
Drunken crab.
When they just put them in alcohol and you eat this raw crab.
And once this is then eaten, that parasite kind of migrates through the tissues and ends up in the lungs. It can cause these lesions inside the lungs. So here's a diagrammatic version of it. The eggs and the feces. This is all the asexual reproduction. This is the movement through free living environment into second intermediate host and predation. Okay. Now here's sort of the Barry's bar napkin genetic diagram of the idea that some genes are expressed in one life cycle stage that are not expressed in the other. So, and yet there is some fraction of the genetic makeup of a species that is there the whole time. That's the species stuff. So it's not really clear how best to draw this idea, but these would be distinct life cycle stages, and so some genetic information is carried along and some is expressed only per life cycle stage. And there's a fair amount, well, the other way to sort of diagram this would be with a, it's much prettier, with a Venn diagram. And so the actual design of this might vary depending on the species. There's actually a reasonable amount of research on this genetic problem. However, the vast majority of that research is not necessarily focused on the biology of development or the biology of transformation from one site to another, but the identification of proteins and genetic sites and genes that might be useful in diagnosis or in treatment or in vaccine development. And so if somebody's looking for really an interesting seminar later in the semester, I suggest that you get into the schistosome literature especially and start pulling out all of that genetic information and try to kind of assemble it, simply because you may discover that people who are studying gene frequencies and loci in Sicaria might not really even be talking to those that are doing the same thing in sporocysts or in adult schistos, what have you. So somebody should really, and this would be an interesting doctoral dissertation in the history of science, I think, really. The development of this whole body of schistosome genetics that is not necessarily focused on the biology of that complex life cycle as much as it is on control. Finish then with what I call the Red Queen problem, and this is a phrase straight out of the Alice in Wonderland stuff. So this is a quote from Wikipedia. There's a quote in there, I think, in which the Red Queen says to Alice, it takes all the running you can do just to keep in the same place. So this is I'm not sure it's a metaphor, but it's a way of expressing the idea of two bodies of some kind in conflict, and what one body does is matched by an action from the other to protection. So hurt, resist, or pathology, immunology, pathology. So there's this sort of an evolutionary arms race is the phrase you hear in seminars. Now the other focus or the other part of this Red Queen hypothesis is that it's supposed to explain sex in the sense that sexual reproduction, which is supposed to produce more genetic diversity than asexual reproduction, is then assumed to provide many more genetic options for responding to a pathogen of some kind. Okay, so within a population, if your population is diverse and part of that population gets infected or damaged, then you're better off to have this diversity, which includes members of that population that are not affected. So that's where these things come from. This is an idea, in my opinion, that is derived entirely from the human experience, if not the human genome. It may be deeply embedded in our ways of looking at the world. And Carl, the anthropologist, you know, you may want to at some point give us, you know, a seminar on the whole idea of how humans think because they're humans. You know, we're afraid of the bear at the cave entrance, and so we respond to a threat. And if you sort of get emails from Ben Sasse or you get mailings from him, you'll see that they're blazoned with the threat that Obama is going to take away your guns and I'm going to protect you, when in fact the data might really show that Obama has done more to boost the domestic weapons industry than Bush ever thought about doing. So, yeah, there's this sort of human perception of what the world is like.
I have a point here on the Red Queen hypothesis.
Yeah.
It says here, it intends to explain two different phenomena. The constant extinction rates as observed in the paleontological record caused by coevolution between competing species. There's no data that showed that.
Absolutely none.
So, and the point is that the extinction rates are not constant because they're episodic.
So you should get in and edit the Wikipedia entry.
Well, yeah, but then you get into this editing thing. Whoever wrote it would then edit it back.
I know.
It doesn't work. Anyway.
Okay.
So just just for you guys who think about this stuff, is that there is no constant extinction rate. There might be over 4 billion years, but if you look at it in sequential time periods or distinct time periods, it's episodic. And the extinction rates are episodic and they're not caused by coevolution at all. So
this is a this is an athletic contest idea. So to kind of explore that a little bit, I picked out an item that we've been working on for at least 15 years. Again, a theoretical paper, which the coding got so complicated I just gave it up because I had other stuff to do. And I knew that it was so counter to prevailing wisdom that nobody would work on it, so it was safe. So let's talk about the cellular immune response just a little bit relative to the Red Queen and whether or not, in fact, there can be an evolutionary arms race between a pathogen and a host. Is it possible? Well, in the case of parasites, at least eukaryotic parasites, the vast majority of them produce cellular immune responses and not humoral. And cellular immune responses, every 6 months, if you get into the literature on immunology, you find out that cellular immunity has become more complicated, when in fact, almost on a monthly basis. So these diagrams, once they're published, in which they have all of these cytokines, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, there may have been three or four cytokines. Next two or three years, there are five or six more, and then more, and then more. And once you get more, then you get roles for them, and then you get receptor sites for them. So there is a staggering amount of genetic information implied by that diagram. I've simplified it, however, just by picking out four events, okay? Four relationships. So let's consider A, B, C, D, E, a cascade or a sequence of events, each of them controlled by genetic information of some kind, producing a whole range of things like transcription factors or binding sites or what have you. I mean, there's all of our cytokines. So I just picked four. Okay, and let's just say that without a red slash, this whole set of events has to occur before a host can mount a cellular immune response. Okay, now, you start thinking about this a little bit. A mutation at any one of these places can can in fact produce susceptibility. And conversely, if this host is susceptible without the red, susceptible without the red, then a mutation someplace could make it resistant. So what you can't really say is that generation after generation after generation of red queen competition between host and pathogen, that mutation that either produces resistance or allows infection is going to occur at the same spot in that very, very, very complex set of events. So this is the fundamental reason, in my view, why the red queen hypothesis is not even anywhere near rational biologically. Sure.
So when you have the red slashes, does that mean that population, so just looking at the first line, the red slash, does that mean A is not, or A is evolving, or A is not? So you've got A is not going to be.
So what?
So you're not getting that mutation, so A would stay A all the way through.
Let's envision a population that's only this top line, without the red slash. So let's say...
So what does the red slash mean?
Well, the red slash can mean either a mutation that prevents this link from happening, or a mutation... Well, if it's a mutation, if these processes all have to occur in order to generate an effective cellular immune response, then a mutation here could shut down that response.
Right.
So you never get no E produced.
Yeah, no E produced.
Yeah.
But no E is produced in at least three other ways.
Yeah.
In this very, very simple diagram. But you could also think of it as the other kind is exactly the flip side of that. So that you might have to have a red slash somewhere in the whole process for infection to occur, and a mutation would then, you know, I suppose instead of a red slash we could have put a little yellow smiley face or something. You know what I mean?
Well, I was just confused because it still continues to E, so in actuality it would stop at A and
yeah,
stop at C. And
no, you're absolutely right. So if I had anticipated your question, I probably would have made these arrows in something almost invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Actually, with PowerPoint, you could hit it and say, okay,
yeah.
Show the cascading.
Yeah, yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah.
It's a good way to look at it.
So the point is, genetic event resulting in either susceptibility or resistance can occur in a variety of places. And if you go back to that original cellular immune reaction response, it would occur in a whole lot of places. So that with this multiple cause system, it's not entirely clear that this scenario can in fact occur. And I think, quite frankly, if you were a theoretician, you could sit down and demonstrate fairly easily that if the protective response is cellular, then it would be a statistical impossibility in real life for that red queen to hypothesis to even begin to work. So I did some, look at red queen in biological abstracts. Since the 1930s, there have been 130 papers, so this is not exactly anywhere near matching the interest in immunology, and almost half of those have been in the last 4 years, and 20% of those were co-authored at least by Kurt Lively. And so he is working then with a snail trematode model in which the trematodes, I'm not sure, have ever really been identified to species. I think they're microphalids, but somebody may want to check on that just to be fair to him. But this is a case where You have both asexual and sexual reproduction in the snails, and Kurt has exploited that system over and over and over again to really test that part of the Red Queen hypothesis. So this is an area of thinking, of genetic thinking, that has not really blossomed or given rise to what you might think of as the expected interest in research. So somebody really needs to kind of do a philosophy of science project on the Red Queen. I think that this is, rather than trying to make it biology, I think we should do it as a piece of philosophy of science. How do you do science? How do your ideas shape your research and the research interests? Okay, take homes. It's always an interesting experience, exercise to actually examine some of these widely or deeply held beliefs and how they direct our research agenda, and relationships between what can be done and what should be done is sometimes that relationship is allowable by nature, and sometimes it's not. But I think the driving force in most of the genetic research, I think you'll discover if you really get into that literature, in parasitology at least, is driven by what can be done. And the talk is all about what should be done. So Barry's Bar and Grill may be really the best place to discuss parasite genetics. But 9:15 this seminar, is a pretty close second.
Thanks.
Go back a slide. How did you resolve it back to what are the last two words? Intellectual polemics.
Compromise. It's always compromise tainted with intellectual politics.
Politics.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I'm doing is important.
Right.
Okay. I'm studying this big hypothesis.
It must be important.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think if you go to seminars on Thursday afternoon, this slide will come to mind. So, I'm going to give you all a rare treat, a rare look into what it's like to be 77 years old. If I can just get on the internet, how long will it take us?
To hook up your computer? Just turn it on?